Hello, everybody. My name is Stephen Sheehan, and I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor, and I also sponsor people that sponsor people.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what this is about. Okay? I really don't want to spend a whole lot of time qualifying myself as an alcoholic and an addict, you know. But I'm going to tell you a few things that set my course. And then I want to talk about the past 1,365 days since I've actually sobered up and stayed sober, you know. And so I was born in Houston, 69. My mom was an alcoholic and a drug addict. My earliest recollection of alcohol was being in one of them wind-up chairs, you know. I don't even think I could talk, but I remember it specifically. It was one of them wind-up chairs. There was a storm brewing, and I could hear my mom and whoever it was she was with screaming and arguing in the other room, and the lightning was flashing, and the thunder was rolling and shit, and I was screaming for everything that I had within me. And then the next thing you know, there was this loud ka-thunk, you know what I'm saying, which was a sippy cup. And I grabbed a sippy cup and I put it to my mouth and it was liquid fucking fire, you know. And all of a sudden I screamed some more and then it started to wash over me. And I was like, oh, let me try that again, you know. So later on in life, right, I used to go live with my grandmother who was an alcoholic. My grandmother, rest her soul, killed herself when I was 7 years old. No, when I was 10 years old. She got in an argument with my uncle, and she said, well, I'll just drink myself to death. And he slammed the door and said, well, why don't you do it, bitch? And she proceeded to take 2 half gallons of vodka and drink them on an empty stomach. We put her in the ground on Christmas Day. Okay? To say that I come from a long line of dysfunctionality would be a gross understatement. My family puts the funk in dysfunctionality. Okay? And okay, I'm a very funky white boy. Play that funky music, white boy. You know? So, my mother was a Bandidos Bikers girl. And so, when I was a toddler, you know, between the ages of about 3 and 6 years old, when my mom had me in tow, when she couldn't get a babysitter for both of us, because my aunt and uncle were like, we don't want him. He's kind of problematic, you know. And so they would take my sister over there to my aunt and uncle's house, and I would either be in tow with my mom and all of her rowdy boyfriends and shit, or I would go to my grandmother's house. When I went to my grandmother's house, I got to drink her special OJs and have cigarettes, you know, running around singing Freddie Fender, Wasted Days and Wasted Nights, you know. And I love my grandma's house, you know what I'm saying? And but when I was with my mom and her boyfriends and shit, you know, it was all about playing Puff the Magic Dragon, you know, because my job was to break the weed up so we could play Puff the Magic Dragon. They would shotgun me marijuana, dude, and I loved it, dude, you know. And so by the time I was 7 years old, my mom was in full-blown addiction. We had moved around. So my first experience with God, I was about 6 years old, and I was upstairs. My mom was at work, and her boyfriend Travis was there at the house, and he was working on his motorcycle. And I was upstairs, and I was listening to Bad, Bad Leroy Brown just a little too loud, and I was just being a little too animated. And he came up, and I guess he was just having a bad day, you know, because he proceeded to make me stand on my tippy toe, and he put a dot on the back of the front door, and he made me put my nose in it. And every time that my nose came out of that dot, that son of a bitch whooped me with that cable off that motorcycle brake mercilessly for about 20 minutes, right? And after that whooping, I was so distressed, I ran into my bedroom, and I grabbed my little old pocket knife, which I thought was a machete, you know, and I grabbed my Bible, And I crawled under my bed and I stabbed my Bible until the pages came out. Because how could a God of love and kindness and compassion and care let this happen to a six-year-old little boy that I really didn't feel like I did nothing wrong? Now, don't get it twisted up. I was a problematic child. But at that moment, I hadn't done shit wrong that day. You know? So, fast forward, right? You know, coat hangers, extension cords, you know, locked in the closet. There was a lock on the refrigerator. You know, traumatic shit. Traumatic shit, more traumatic shit. Okay? So, when I was 7 years old, I had just turned seven. My mom, we were living in an empty house. We were basically squatting in an empty house in Denver. And I'd grown up in the Houston area all my life. And we had moved to Denver. She couldn't find no work, and it was obvious that she was on stuff, right? She put us on a plane to go to my aunt and uncle's for Christmas. That was 40 years ago. So most days when I go to bed, I'm still a seven-year-old boy waiting for my mama to come home. I never knew my real father, you know? And then my family lied to me about all the truths about that, and I still don't know the answers, right? And I tell you these things because later on when I was doing four steps and fifth steps and talking to my sponsors and trying to get sober, these are the things that plagued me, over and over and over. And so when I was seven, I went to live with my aunt and uncle. And they dropped us off Christmas. I didn't see her no more. And so I started going to school there with my aunt and uncle. And I was at Clear Lake Elementary School. And to say that I had problems at this point would be a gross understatement. Because in third grade, I took to school a can of lighter fluid, a box of matches. And I asked to be excused to go use the bathroom. And I went to the bathroom and I pulled down every piece of paper there was and I put it out there. And I took that lighter fluid and I went all over all the wall. I lit a match and I threw it in there and I heard it go woof. And I walked back to class, cool as a cucumber, you know what I'm saying? You know, and acted like ain't nothing happened, right? And so then they just proceeded to shake down the entire school, right? And so I really wasn't that slick as a criminal. This should have been my first clue, right? Because the book of matches that I used in which to set the school on fire happened to be the racket club that my uncle owned, you know? And so it had the racket club written on the matchbook, you know? So the little boy saw me, like, slide them behind the deal, you know, and sneaked me out, right? So I was expelled from my first elementary school at 7 years old. And they said, that kid cannot come back here, you know? And so then my aunt and uncle proceeded to try to get me some kind of therapy, you know? And because I had issues, you know, I mean, I got more issues than National Geographic, okay? So, you know, the bottom line is that, so they got me, you know, a year goes by, and they build a new house in Friendswood, you know, 20 miles away. New school, new thing, you know, everything was new, and to give me a new start, right? Now, mind you, they got two kids of their own, and I've got a sister that was dropped off with, you know. So now they have four kids instead of two, right? And at this point, they have adopted us, right? And so my name's also changed three times at this point, you know, because I was born Stephen Sheehan, and I got changed Stephen Otisor, and then I got changed to Stephen Ham. So anyways, go to a new school, got the new name, everything's cool, right? Yeah, that didn't last very long. I think I was about 2 months into Friendswood Elementary School. I was kind of a dick, man, you know. I wind up killing the school gerbils on accident, you know, because I just wanted to see how high they would fly, you know. And so I threw a desk at a teacher. And because I was really twisted, my teacher said some stuff to me one day. And she was about 6 months pregnant. And I proceeded to threaten to kick her in the stomach and kill her unborn child if she ever talked to me that way again. And so then again, my aunt and uncle got the phone call of, that kid can never come back to the school, ever. Right? And so my aunt and uncle didn't know what to do with me, right? And so there's a place out in Amarillo called Cal Farley's Boys Ranch, if any of y'all have ever heard of it. And it's basically for orphans. It was started back in the late 30s. And so with no other recourse and kicked out of two, expelled from two elementary schools and asked to never come back, my aunt and uncle had no clue of what to do with me, you know. So they sent me to Cal Farley's Boys Ranch. And I was 10 years old. And the range of ages for the boys in the dorms were from 10 years old to 18, right? So I was the youngest, the littlest, you know, and I was there about a month and got raped, you know? And then this proceeded to happen for a couple more years till I could, like, get the fuck away, you know what I'm saying? Where I could get away, you know? And so by the time I was 12, 13, you know, I'd had all these things happen to me, right? Now, I remember growing up, remember I told you about my first experience with God, right? Well, the other thing was, so when I was a kid, they told me about the Easter Bunny, right? Which I found out was a farce, you know? They told me about the Tooth Fairy, you know, which turned out to be a woolly booger too, right? And then Santa Claus. You know, and that was the biggest okie doke of all, you know what I mean? And so then when I was in boys' school, we were made to go to church every Sunday, twice, and every Wednesday we had to go to church, you know? And then during the week, we had to attend these Bible studies and stuff, right? So I guess it was somewhere when I was about 11 years old, I had earned my way to go to Bible camp, and I had my first kind of experience with God. You know, and I was still really pissed off at God, you know, because my life has just pretty much been shit from day one, you fucker, you know, excuse my language. But, you know, it just, I felt like God had it out for me and I could not figure out why I was destined to have all this crap happen to me, right? And I didn't feel like it was fair, you know. So, you know, I was at boys' school for, you know, 5 years. And I remember my aunt and uncle, they decided that they were going to bring me home from Cal Farley's, right? And I was 15. And I remember coming home, and I got drunk the first time, six-pack, and I was out of there, you know? But I'll never forget the first time that I smoked weed at 15 years old after I got out of Cal Farley's Boys Ranch. And when I smoked that first joint, it was like all of those childhood memories of being drugging around with my mom and whatnot, it just hit me in a moment. I got like 1,000 repressed childhood memories just slammed in my head at one time. And not only that, but it was the feeling that washed over me that said, oh my God, I felt this way before. This is normal shit right here. You know what I'm saying? Because as a young toddler, I've been feeling this, right? That's how they used to, that was my ADHD medicine when I was in the 70s, you know, was alcohol and pot. They couldn't get me to calm down any other way. And there's a few people in here that know I'm still just as animated today. You know what I'm saying? You know, my first addiction was attention. You know, and I'm still addicted to it today. You know, I'm a little bit better, but not much. But anyways, the long and the short of it is, so I get out of boys school and I go back to the high school, right? I go back to the high school in the city where I was expelled, told to never come back. And the principal from the elementary school from 5 years ago is now the assistant principal at the high school. So it was a really awkward conversation when she called me into her office the first day of school. And she goes, Mr. Sheehan, we're not going to have any repeats from Westwood, are we? And I was like, oh, no, ma'am. No, ma'am. And so, you know, I tried to do sports. I did a lot of drinking. And, you know, my family owned property right behind the high school. You know, they had 10 acres. So I could get up. It was, you know, 10 minutes after 8. The bell rang at 8:20. I just walked back across the back 2.5 acres and I was at school. I was on Stoner's Road, you know. And because my aunt and uncle had money, I kind of fit into three classes. You know, I was in sports, so I was an athlete, you know, jock. You know, we had money, so we always had nice preppy clothes, so we had that kind of going for it. But I did drugs and alcohol, too, so I got to hang out with all the stoners and the losers, you know. And so I really, at this point in my life, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know who I was. You know, I had all these things happen to me. I'm still waiting for my mama to come home one day, which it never fucking happened. Excuse my language. You know, and so I'm sitting around and I'm waiting for something to change. And nothing changes. And I start skipping class. And I get called into the principal's office again. And so it was shortly after that, I run away. I run away from home. I just turned 16. I ran away. Well, my aunt and uncle then dropped custody of me. And when they dropped custody of me, Child Protective Services picked up custody of me. And so I managed to go through like 4 or 5 30-day shelters. I got kicked out for numerous assaults and terroristic threats and, you know, because I'm a hoodlum. And I got anger issues. I wonder why I got anger issues. I can't figure that one out yet, dude. You know, and so I get sent out to a group home. And I'm out there in West Texas, out in Fort Davis. And it's basically a group home for people coming out of state school, which is basically TDC for youngsters, you know. And so I'm out there and I tried suicide for the first time. Stone cold sober. I didn't like who I was. I hung myself. I still got the scar around my neck. And I hung in a tree for about 20 minutes before they were able to cut me out, get me down. And I was in a coma for about 3 days. And I lost all the feeling on one side of my face for about 6 months because it had done damage to the nerves and whatnot. And somehow I made it through. You know, I don't know why, but I didn't really have any like white light experience or, you know, go back, Stephen, or none of that kind of stuff. You know, I'm not done with you. I didn't. There was none of that. You know, so. So I'm at group home, and they allow you to work in school at your own pace. And I've never been a dummy, you know. If anything, I've been too smart for my own good most times. And school kind of bored me. But there, they let us work at our own pace. So I managed to do half my sophomore year, all of my junior year, and all of my senior year in 1 year. And I was a few months away from, you know, going into the military. And I wind up choking this dude to without about an inch of his life. You know what I'm saying? And so at this point, I'm 17. So they go ahead and press charges on me because the administration didn't like me because I was intimidating everybody, you know, and which is a big Crockett thing. But anyway, that's a whole nother story. I'm not going to get into that. So needless to say, right, I go from there. I get out. They take me. Child Protective Services still has custody of me, so they take me back to Galveston County. They can't put me in jail because I haven't committed any crimes down in Galveston County. And they can't put me in juvie because I'm 17, right? So what do? They emancipate me. I'm 17 years old, 4 months shy of my 18th birthday. I have no job experience. I have no family that wants nothing to do with me. I don't know where I'm at, what I'm doing, and I ain't got a clue. And from the time I'm 10 up to this point, I've been in institutions. I've had people telling me what to do, when to poop, you know what I'm saying, feeding me and stuff, right? So at that point, they took me, Child Protective Services took me to the soup line. And they drove by and they said, if you get hungry, kid, there's a place right here you can come and get you something to eat. And then they proceeded to take me to 23rd and Broadway and drop me off in front of the Salvation Army. And they said, have good life, kid, right? So that day, I said to myself, ain't ne'er swinging dangling ever going to tell me what to do in this life, you know. And I proceeded to rob, steal, do whatever I had to do to get money and to survive. That lasted about 4 months, and I wound up in county jail for the first time, right? I knew they had me, but they didn't have enough evidence. But I knew that, so I held out on them for about 4 months because I was getting free hots and cots, you know. And shit, I mean, I'm used to this. This is what I've been in all these years, you know. And so I get out and I decide I'm going to see the world. And so I hitchhiked from state to state and whatnot. And I had a few God experiences. And, you know, there's a big difference between having a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. And I'll get to that in a minute, you know. So I had a few God experiences on that. And I got hooked up with these people and I started, you know, doing credit card scams and, you know, wind up. I didn't realize it, but I'd been dealing with this guy for 2 years. And so I started running a fencing operation out of the Ritz Car Wash in Broadway down there on 61st in Galveston. And I'm selling dope in the ashtrays, you know what I'm saying? And when I get my tip money, you know what I'm saying? I'm getting my dope money and putting it in the ashtray, doing it all cool and throwing hot stereos and guns and all that until Galveston police surrounded the car wash and took me in, you know? And it wasn't just that, because they held me for a couple days at the city jail, which was really unusual because I didn't know it, but the organized crime control unit had been watching me for 2 years. And so they started pulling out all these 8x10 glossies of Stephen Sheehan doing all the things that Stephen Sheehan was doing back in those days. And I made the front page of the Galveston paper. Island man arrested for over 50 burglaries. One man crime spree taken into custody. And so I had rodeo tickets. You know, if you've ever gotten an indictment in jail, they call them rodeo tickets, you know. And so I had 69 counts of burglary. And I had 3 secret indictments. One for delivery of cocaine a half ounce to an undercover cop. And 2 felony theft. Now, mind you, I don't have a record at this point. So they give me a public defender. My public defender, I'm the very first case he's ever had out of law school. And she was cute to boot, you know. So anyway, she goes in and she talks to the judge and tells him, you know, I give her my sad ass story, you know. And it's a pretty sad ass story when I'm at 18, you know. And so she goes in there and she gets the judge to give me some leniency. And I'll never forget Judge Engelkey. He says, son, I can't help fate's fumbling fingers with your past. He says, but I think the leniency of the court will speak on the behalf of your troubled youth up to this point. He says, I'm going to give you 5 8-year sentences and I'm going to run them concurrent. And I did the math. I said, 8 months, baby. Yeah. Right. Take that one to the bank, baby. Right. So I went to prison, right? And so I go down to prison, and because I'm such a role model, you know, they sent me to a minimum security farm, which I stayed for about 2 weeks. And then they sent me to medium security, which I stayed at for about a month. And then they just sent me straight to maximum security because they said, it's a real knucklehead, right? So I got out of prison. I was in prison 14 months total. I get out, off maximum security, you know, on closed custody. Yeah. And so I get out and I go right back to doing the same stuff, you know, doing all the same things. I skipped out. I wound up in Newport News, Virginia, on the run from the law. And the day that they tried to shut me down, had a gun in the car. I climbed up about a 200-foot tree. I shut down traffic. I jumped in front of moving 18-wheelers. And, you know, because the car rear-ended me, the gun slipped back behind the seat. And that was another spiritual experience where God saved me because I was gonna shoot the cop. Cop had his gun out and was pointing at me, and I was reaching under the seat trying to get my shit. So I just did a dive roll out, you know what I'm saying, in my dress clothes because I was at work, you know. You know, criminals got to be at work, you know, got to have a good cover, dog, you know. And so anyways, thus started my second trip to the penitentiary, right? And that was June 2nd of 1990. And so the only thing that they could get me for was a stolen car, another felony theft. So mind you, now I've got 3 felony thefts on my record. And this is felony number 7. Okay. And I think I had just turned 20. Yeah. And so I remember as a kid, my aunt and uncle saying, son, you're going to be in prison before you're 21. Well, fuck you. I got there at 19, bitch. You know what I'm saying? Because I'm an achiever. You know, I excel. You know, that's what I do. You think I'm a bad apple? I'll show you just how bad I can be. And so, you know, I was, you know, because I was a model inmate, you know, they sent me straight to maximum security, you know, Ferguson with all the gladiators. And, you know, I don't know. I'm young, pretty, and white, and I still walked out with my butthole tight. So let me just say it like that, okay? All right? At this point, I was young, pretty, and white, and, you know, and so let's just say it like that. I'm just going to leave it alone at that, all right? So because I, you know, I ain't scared, you know, right? So now, mind you, I have already tried to commit suicide the second time, you know, when I was living in Galveston. I took a bunch of pills and I cut my wrist and they found me on the seawall. And so that was suicide attempt number two, right? I really wanted to check out. I was stone cold sober when I did it. So I'm in Ferguson just, you know, doing what I do, you know, and hating the world. I was an equal opportunity hater. I didn't care what color you were or what you were talking about. I didn't trust nobody. I didn't need nobody. You know, and if you want to take, then I'm going to sink you, white boy, after. And I said, I wish you would, dog, please. Do something for me I can't do for myself. I've already failed twice, man. Right? So after about 2 years, right, I get the Dear John letter from the girl I was so deeply in love with, right? And I was like, man, forget it, you know? I didn't have no family wanting nothing to do with me. I didn't, you know, I've been in institutions since I was 10. Right? So nobody's going to care if another inmate, or as I call myself, a convict. I ain't no inmate. I'm a convict, bitch. You know, right? You know, I'd say, who's going to care? So when I get this letter, I went to my cell and, you know, I took the sheet and I braided it. You know what I'm saying? Into 3 inches. And I braided it and I tied it to my locker and I jumped up and down on it. You know? So when the doors rolled the next day and I fell out with my commissary bag and dropped it on the run, and the boss says, inmate, get back in here. I said, fuck you, I'm gone. And I said, you're taking me out of here today, either on parole or a body bag. It's your choice. And I proceeded to crawl up into the four row windows, which is about 30 feet up in the air. And I tied the rope, right, around my neck. And I tied it around the deal. Don't ask me how. Somehow the damn rope broke. Okay. So the windows that were underneath me were open, too. So when the rope broke, one of my legs caught in the window and it turned me upside down and I landed 30 feet head first on that concrete. And I kind of came to and it felt like somebody had put me to sleep, you know. And I kind of came to and I was on the run and I was like, damn, damn. It's like, shit. I'm like, man, I can't get nothing right, dude. Shit. And so I realized at that point that maybe God does have something for me. Because, see, when I was at that church camp when I was 11, I accepted Christ as my personal Lord and Savior. And I thought it was going to be some kind of magic fairy dust that was going to make my life all gravy and pretty and beautiful. But it didn't, you know. And I made a lot of bad choices after that, you know. So I'm 25 years old. I'm waiting on a halfway house, right? And I'm going to try to hurry. I'm in a halfway house. I'm in penitentiary waiting for a halfway house. It's 6 months to 2 years on the waiting list, right? And I didn't have no option. All of a sudden, I get what I call my angel in the envelope. I get a letter from some lady I ain't never laid eyes on. I don't know who she is, telling me that she's going to give me a viable option of I can parole to her address, and she's going to help me out. And I was like, what the fuck is going on here, dude? That's the mother of my children. She's third generation raised up on a Pentecostal church pew. You know what I'm saying? Woman got a heart of gold, just pure as can be. I dogged that woman for years, man. You know what I'm saying? The first time I ever laid eyes on the mother of my children, I was in the maximum security visitation booth. You know? And she turned around and walked away, and I said, oh, my goodness, look at that. Right? I was in love ever since, you know? And so the bottom line is I get out, I get out the penitentiary. It's just been over 22 years since I stepped out of penitentiary on August the 2nd of 1995. Almost exactly 1 year to the day after I got out the penitentiary, that beautiful young lady on the back row right there, Clarissa, stand up for 1 second, please. It's my 21-year-old daughter. Now, I introduce her not to embarrass her, but for 11 years of my addiction, right, I was not a part of her life, right? And that man sitting in front of her one day told me, he says, get a year, Stephen. I'm in his kitchen crying, and he snatches me up. He says, stop crying. He says, get a year, and let's see what happens. And of course, I wouldn't do it. And this other great man sitting right here who took me into his house, you know what I'm saying, when I had smoked myself out back up under the bridge with no place to live. Because I did a whole lot of overhead welding. You know what I'm saying? If anybody know what that is, I smoked crack. Yeah, I smoked a whole lot of crack, dude. You know? And I wasn't a picky drug addict or alcoholic. What I wanted was whatever was free and whatever I could tell you about my sad ass story to make you feel sorry for me to want you to give me more. You know what I'm saying? And so I used that as emotional currency. Right? Because from the time I was 10 to the time I was 25, I spent 13 and a half years in institutions. So when I met the mother of my children, you know, and I gave her my first real paycheck after working 7 days, and it was like $320. And I was like, baby, I can make that shit in about 15 minutes on the Conan, man. You know? But it was a legitimate paycheck. Now, mind you, that didn't work out. I'm going to tell you about a couple of God experiences, and I want to really get into the last 3.5 years of sobriety, okay? So, one of the God experiences I had is that I found out that the guy who was on my birth certificate wasn't my real dad, blah, 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 blah. I go to church, right? Now, I've been believing in God, and I've been taught all this stuff, and I sing in church choirs, and I've done this, and I'm married to a Pentecostal, and I take my daughters to church even when I don't feel like it, because I take them every Sunday because I want to teach them in the way that I wasn't taught. Right, so I take them regardless of what I'm feeling or what's going on in my life or how much dope I did last week. You know, I still take them. So my marriage is on the rocks. I'm still strung out on cocaine. You know, we ain't got no money. And now I got all these lies that my family's been telling me for all these years. And so my wife calls me and she says, hey, brother so-and-so's got a church down here. My mom says it's really good. You want to go check it out? I said, baby, I got to go. Right? So I go to church. I've never been to this church. I don't know anybody. And I go in, and they're having the song part of the service, praying and clapping and praising and whatnot. And then the pastor says, if you've got something you need to pray about, why don't you come on down? So I already knew what time it was. You know what I'm saying? I stepped right on out and hustled down there, right? Because I had something to talk to God about that day, right? So I get down there, and I got my arms crossed and my head bowed, my eyes closed. And I'm silently petitioning God. I say, God, my marriage is on the rocks. My family been lying to me. I ain't got no money. Ba, 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 da, 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 da. And all of a sudden, I had this thought that I had a shield in one hand and a sword in the other hand. And I think to myself, Stephen, you crazy, dog. Because now you're in church and you're praying and you think you're Conan the Barbarian and shit, right? And so I'm like, dude, you're like committable, right? So I take this thought and I take this thought and I dismiss it as complete lunacy, right? Now, mind you, I've never been to this church before and I don't know anybody. So as soon as I take this thought with my head bowed, my eyes closed, my arms crossed, and I throw it out of my mind, this man walks up behind me and whispers in my ear. He says, Stephen, God just told me to tell you that he put a sword in your hand. Now, at that moment in my life, I knew the God that I had been believing in and talking to and praying to had showed up. And he showed up in a way that was supernatural, right? So, fast forward from that experience, right? Fast forward a few years. My wife, I get out of treatment for the second time, and I go to pick up my truck from the apartment where she's taking the kids. She goes, I want a divorce. Oh, by the way, I have a boyfriend. I'm like, bitch, I've only been gone 30 days. What are you talking about? You know? And so I'm thinking to myself, you know, what do I do? So I play along with her, right? She takes the kids completely out of my life. Now, mind you, I tried the best I could not having any parenting in my coming up, you know, to be the best father I knew how to be or what I thought I could be, right? And I was a stay-at-home father with my kids for, I don't know, probably 2 to 3 years of their early years. And I was there with them every day. I was cook, clean, do the blue jeans, all that shit. I was Mr. Mom, you know, taking them down to the pool and the playground and all those things. And I changed more dirty diapers than my wife ever thought about changing, okay? So when she took those kids from me, it destroyed me. I mean, it just cut me off at the knees and I felt completely incapacitated, right? Because the only thing that I did right when I got out of the penitentiary was I had that beautiful girl a year later, you know? And then I had another one a couple years after that. So I was at Willowick Oxford House. You know, they made me the president. And all I would do was every night cry, you know, because I didn't know what else to do. Right? And so here in Austin for 14 years, I've been in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out. Get 3 months, I'm gone. Get 2 months, I'm gone. Get 6 months, I'm gone. You know, get the car back, get the job back, get the girl back. Whatever it may be, I'm gone. Holla at you. I'm cured. Right? Because I made a vow to myself that I was never going to let another grown-ass man tell me what to do when I was 17. Because nobody was there. Nobody was there to help me up. I had to fend for myself. So the reason Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't work for me because I was unwilling to let go of my old ideas, which it tells me about on page 58. It says some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was kneel until we let go. Absolutely. Right? But then here's the thing. It says half measures availed us nothing. So I come in here and I half-ass some shit. Guess what? I get nothing. I don't get no half results. I don't get three-quarters. I don't even get a coat. I don't get an eight. I don't get none. I get zip, zip, zero, not a goose egg. You know, that's it. So it wasn't until 4 years ago when I sat across from that man at the table and he says, it sounds to me like you know about God because you say you can talk that book better than my pastor do. I said, yeah, so don't come at me sideways, right? You know, and so mind you, I got a big old hairdo here, right? You know, poofed out. I'm out on the corner flying a sign, living under the bridge. Oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you, you know. The last time that I've been doing my little runs, doing cocaine, right? Running around bipping Starbucks tip jars so I could support my habit, right? I got arrested one day for a possession charge, and they called me in 2 weeks later, and they said, Mr. Sheehan, you're being charged with felony theft. I said, felony theft for what? You know? They said, it looks here like you stole a Starbucks tip jar. I said, man, that ain't no felony. I said, man, that's a classy misdemeanor, less than $100, baby. He said, oh, no, Mr. Sheehan. Let me explain something to you. He says, you have three prior felony thefts, two of which you've been to the penitentiary for. He says, if you so much as steal a pack of bubble gum in the state of Texas, we can enhance that to a felony. Oh, and guess what? Because you have two priors, we can charge you as a habitual. So the next time you decide you want to pick up a pack of bubble gum at the store, think about doing life in the penitentiary. I did 5.5 years on Ferguson. I see what lifers do. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't going to be that dumbass going into HEB and getting a life sentence for a summer sausage. Say, dog, what you did? I sold summer sausage, man. You mean you didn't kill nobody? No, I just stole summer sausage, dog. Yeah. So that's why I was eating out of the dumpster. I wasn't eating out of the dumpster because I wanted to. It's because I'm smart enough to know I don't want to go to penitentiary for stealing summer sausage. Right? So, I'm living under the bridge, 2222 Mopac, flying a sign, you know, and I decided, you know what? I think I'm done. Now, mind you, I didn't even bring up all the Travis County mug shots and shit, you know what I'm saying, over 7 years, you know, and all the times I went to jail for possession, but I didn't manage to go back to the penitentiary, you know, but, you know, during all that time, I kept going back to AA because I knew if I couldn't do nothing else at AA, if I wasn't going to get sober, I could come tell you my sad ass story. You going to give me $5 more? So I'll go get me another rock. I got some more overhead welding to do, dog. You know? And the thing was, is that I would go into AA and a lot of great, great men would come up and they would give me great advice, or they would take me under their wing and they would say, come on, you know, and I'm just too stupid because I'm a special kind of stupid, you know. And so this last time I came in, I was at Northland. I was going to Northland meeting on 7:30. I've been trying to wean myself. Now, I am alumni of Austin Recovery. I've been here 3 times. Yeah, give a big hand. All right. 3 times. Yeah. Well, when I got to number 4, they said, no. We're good. You're good. You know? We're good. We've had you, Mr. Yan, 3 times. We know you. We're not going there again. You know? At which time I proceeded to smash the gas. And I tried to kill myself by getting high and drunk. But the more that I put in my body, the more sober I got. I'm like, this is fucking dumb. What am I going to do here? So I crawled my old hot ass. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the last time, you know, I looked like hell. I smelled like I heard a wild goat. I looked like I just crawled out of the woods because I had, you know. And I went in there and I asked that guy to be my temporary sponsor because I had been to enough AA meetings to know I needed a sponsor. And I sat at that cross from the table, that man, and I said, look here. He said, man, he says, let me ask you a question. He says, do you want to serve the King of Kings or do you want to serve King Alcohol? And the thought that came to my mind was a totally different scripture, but it says that no man can serve two masters. You know what I'm saying? And somehow it was like people when they pull a one-armed bandit and all the lights go off and go, ting, 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 and the confetti falls down and sits. And I was like, epiphany, right? Another God experience, right? The lights had come on. And he asked me, he says, are you willing to be uncomfortable for a few days? And I said, yeah. So the very next day, right, this old lady came up to me, and I mean, she was an older lady. She's 20-something years my senior, and she walks over to me. She sees me on the couch, and she says, "Stephen," she says, "I've been watching you come in and out of here for 5 years." She says, "You don't let this old motherfucker run you off this time." I said, "Yes, ma'am." She says, "You stay." I said, "Yes, ma'am." She said, "I know you're living under that bridge." She said, "You bring your ass here and you sleep on these benches after 10 o'clock. She said, "Don't walk around. Don't do nothing. You come here and you sleep and you get your ass up and you go to the 7:30 meeting." I said, "Yes, ma'am." That day, later that day, I saw pillows and blankets over there by the shed over there, right? And then the very next day, this very beautiful, sweet old lady, Miss Janice, came up to me before the meeting. She said, "I've got some clothes for you." And I'm so proud. I got a backpack full of dirty clothes. I don't want none of y'all stuff, you know? She takes me out there. She goes, "Do you need a haircut?" Well, my temporary sponsor had asked me that earlier. You know, my hair's out to here, you know. It looked like I put my hand in a light socket and shit, you know. Yeah. And he's like, you want a haircut? And I was like, well, no. This is my signature, dude. You know, this is what gets me money on the counter, dog. You know what I'm saying? I have a sign that says, "I am here because I'm not all there." You know, and with this hair, that just makes it, that's hide, sell, and deliver, right? So then she asked me, she goes, "Would you like a haircut?" I said, "Well, obviously I need a haircut because you're the second person to ask me that today." And she goes, "Well, when would be a good time?" I was like, "I don't know, I'm real busy under the bridge, you know, I got a lot of appointments and shit, you know, I'm real busy, you know, I don't know, when can you work me in there, you know?" And, And I told her, I said, "You know what, Miss Janice?" I said, "This is all nice and real sweet and everything." I said, "But, you know," I said, "more than anything, I just want to wash my dirty ass." I said, "I ain't been bathed in a week." And I said, "And I stink and I can smell myself." And I said, "I know other people can smell me too." And she looked at me. She says, "You go get your backpack." This woman, married, got kids, whatnot, takes me to her house, gets me set up in the shower. You know what I'm saying? Takes me in. Makes me a sandwich, feeds me, talks to me, cuts my hair, and then takes my old backpack full of fucking dirty clothes, washes every bit of them, folds them, dries them, brings them back up to the club at 5:30, and gives me a kiss on the cheeks and says, "We're glad you're here." Aww. 2 days later, I found the sponsor that I wanted. And a lot of times when I quote a sponsor, I quote a sponsor because I've had a lot of great sponsors. And it's always not just one sponsor. I've had a lot of great sponsors over the years. But I'll say this, and I'm going to wrap it up. The thing is, he gave me a lot of really good things. He said, number one, don't be a dick. You know, just stop being a dick. And he says, if you want to stay sober, mind your own freaking business, dude. You know what I'm saying? And he says, guess what? You got a hula hoop around you. It's about 12 inches of space. He says, you've got control of two things inside there. Your choices and your perspective. Guess what? If I think life sucks, right? If I think I ain't getting paid enough, guess what? I ain't getting paid enough. But I was singing that shit fucking months ago when I was unemployable under the bridge, you know? The thing is, here's the thing. Everything outside of that hula hoop, what so-and-so said, who so-and-so she's sleeping with, or what she did and what he said and how he screwed me over and my sponsor screwed my girlfriend and all that other bullshit ain't none of my freaking business. None of it. None of it. And as long as I keep a good attitude and a good perspective on life, guess what? My life's going to be all right. If I mind my own business and don't be a dick. Right? Now, the other thing I'll say is get a sponsor. Get a sponsor that's got a sponsor. And then start sponsoring people and teach your sponsees how to sponsor people. Because ultimately, I wouldn't be standing here if somebody hadn't taken me through the steps that had been taken through the steps. So that's how this thing works. So, you know, I could go on for another hour. I'm not going to bore y'all with any more of that shit. If you want my the other thing that he gave me that was really, really, you know, like, my sponsor said, we just say yes. We just say yes. We don't ask how or why or what or whatever. If they say, hey, you want to bring the topic? We just say yes. You know, hey, man, I got somebody that needs to move this way. Okay, yeah, I'll help you. We just say yes, right? And by just saying yes, and my first 6 months, I cleaned the commodes at Cherry Creek like Virgin Mary was coming in there to take a dump on them sons of guns. You know what I'm saying? Right? She would have been proud to go in there because I kept. And what it did is if you want to find a home group and you want to have a home group, find out where the mop is. That's how you know you found a home group, because you know you can clean up your own house. Because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is, and the meeting's there. Okay, so my time's up. Thanks.